Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, the hour is approaching. We are soon going to learn just what Sonia Sotomayor has to hide.
You're talking about July 13th, the confirmation hearings.
Right now, we're looking forward to July 13th.
Wait, we meaning...
All of Washington.
No, official Washington.
No, Ken, the anticipation is in the streets.
The Republican Party is not looking forward to July 13th because they say it's too soon.
It's too soon. Well, I agree. It probably is too soon because, you know, 47, 48 days is really not enough to prepare for these hearings because, after all, she's been on the bench a number of years. I think they actually do have kind of an argument here, although, of course, that's the amount of time they had to prepare for John Roberts.
Well, and that was Pat Leahy's argument, saying, well, you know, I don't know why you're complaining. This is what we got for John Roberts. But in the Republicans' defense, they say they learned about the July 13th date from the news media, that there was no consultation by Leahy.
No, they didn't learn it from the news media. They learned it from Pat Leahy going out on the floor of the Senate and saying on Tuesday...
Well, they did say they learned it from the news media.
We learned it in the media. Well, they learned it in the media because they weren't there on the floor
right.
of the Senate to hear it. Well, wait a minute, Ken. If the Republicans are seriously upset about July 13th, if that's too soon, what kind of mechanical devices are available to the Republicans to slow down this nomination before we even get to a confirmation?
They could cry. They could go home. They could take it. Well, actually, they could. They could pick up their ball and go home by meaning they could just boycott the confirmation hearings.
They could boycott the hearings. And that would certainly broadcast to everyone that they felt that this was an illegitimate process. And a certain number of people would probably agree with them. Why don't they do that?
Because that certain number is probably 9 people in the country, whereas the rest of the country would say that they look bad. They look like spoiled sports. As much as the Democrats didn't like Clarence Thomas in 1991 or Haynesworth and Carswell in 1969, 1970, neither side boycotted confirmation hearings.
And so you don't see that as an effective tool or not an arrow in their quiver?
Especially not in a history-making nomination, but in any event, no. And this is part of the problem with the Republican Party because they've been accused by many people of just being the party of no, and they've got to come up with some kind of an alternative. And the alternative right here to Sonia Sotomayor confirmation is what? I don't know what it is.
Well, the confirmation alternative, of course, would be to just line up and vote no. Or they could, in some sense or another, if not boycott the actual hearings, slow down a lot of other Senate business and register protest that way.
But there was a column, and I don't think I've ever quoted Charles Krauthammer in this podcast before.
But do now.
But I will now, because he said something and said, look, raise all the arguments against her and then just vote to confirm her and don't embarrass the party any further.
Yes, I think besides Charles Krauthammer, there have been other conservatives who have said, look, she's going to get confirmed. Let's just assume that if something bad is going to come out, it's going to come out in the next 4 or 5 weeks. This is not a winner for the Republican Party. Let's move on to focusing on the things where the Obama administration is going to be more vulnerable, whether it's spending, whether it's foreign policy, whether it's health care, where there's a great battle brewing in the next couple of months in Congress over the health care plan.
And talking points is certainly what the Republican Party seems to be looking for, at least, because if you watch the media gawking at last week's Republican
fundraising dinner
mm-hmm. in Washington, where they invited Sarah Palin, they didn't invite Sarah Palin, they invited her, Newt Gingrich showed up, would she upstage him, would she see Mitt Romney from her kitchen window? I think if you're a Republican, you say, look, it's a media conspiracy against the Republican Party, but the Republicans themselves haven't looked that good in the process. Newt Gingrich, for all his eloquence and ideological fervor and arguments against Obama, he's yesterday's news. He was elected to Congress in 1978 during Jimmy Carter's administration.
More than 30 years ago.
Exactly. That's not the way to look ahead. And his popularity is not the greatest, even though he does have a lot of ideas and he's bursting with ideas.
No, his popularity isn't that great even among Republicans.
Right.
They're on about 10% in a USA Today Gallup poll this week said he should be the spokesperson for the Republican Party right now. And there wasn't really anybody who got very big numbers in that poll. In fact, roughly half the Republicans in the poll said they didn't know who the Republican Party leader was.
Which is usually the
right
case
now.
For the out party after they lose a presidential election, especially after having it for 8 years.
Yes, in fact, there is a nifty irony here pointed out to us by a Senate aide on the Republican side that showed up in Politico, as a matter of fact, also. And that is that USA Today had run essentially the same story 8 years ago in August of 2001.
They ran it on Thursday of this week, and then they also ran it in 2001.
Only, of course, in that instance, it was the Democrats who had just lost the White House, and they were asking Democrats at that time, who's the leader of your party? And about half of them said, we don't know. And about 10% said Bill Clinton, and another small percentage said Al Gore. And they were just as much in the wilderness at that time. The funny part is that in that article, USA Today reporter Susan Page quoted a political consultant saying this is what happens when a political party loses power. And that political consultant was David Axelrod, who not too long after that started working for a young Illinois politician named Barack Obama.
I think there are tremendous parallels, but the difference here is are the Republicans that people are seeing as the leaders, or at least the Republicans that the media are portraying as leaders, are not the most popular Republicans in the world, and that's the Dick Cheneys, the Newt Gingriches, and perhaps even Rush Limbaughs.
Or George W. Bush, for that matter.
Right. Well, Bush, for his part, George W. Has been staying out of the limelight, but actually you can't say the same thing about George H.W. Bush.
No, H.W. Bush, this is a fascinating fact. The man is turning 85, and he's marking this birthday the same way he marked his 80th birthday, by jumping out of an airplane.
Yes, this time with a parachute. The question is, what's more crazy, picking Dan Quayle for vice president or jumping out of an airplane at the age of 85?
Somebody else who might feel like jumping out of an airplane right now is Terry McAuliffe. I'm sorry, I shouldn't laugh. Terry McAuliffe took the plunge into electoral politics after many years as a fundraiser, as a political organizer, as a close friend of the Clintons, and he ran for governor of Virginia, where he had actually been living in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. for a number of years, and clock cleaned, hat handed to him?
No, well, first of all, he did beat Brian Moran.
Barely. He almost finished third in a primary that he was supposed to utterly dominate and had been utterly dominating until recent weeks.
Well, the best story about this whole thing is not so much that Creed Deeds, the rural kind of conservative Democratic state senator, won.
R. Creed Deeds. Let's not leave out that R at the beginning of his name. He is R.
Well,
Creed Deeds.
I think he's your Creed Deeds.
Well, he's R. Creed Deeds now.
He's not R. Creed Deeds.
Yes, he is.
But anyway, yes, he did run for attorney general 4 years ago, but for the most part, with Brian Moran being a leader in the Democratic caucus in the state House of Delegates, with Terry McAuliffe being the former Democratic National Committee Chairman.
National Committee Chairman.
Nobody ever knew who Creed Deeds was, and yet he got 50% of the vote. He carried the entire state, including Northern Virginia, which is, one, the most liberal part of the state, and two, where McAuliffe and Moran live.
And how about a little shout-out here to the Washington Post. Their editorial, strongly endorsing Creed Eads over two local guys from the Washington area, was clearly pivotal in this race. You look at all the charts on the polls, and Creed Eads takes off with that particular endorsement, which suddenly gave him presence in the Democratic vote-rich Northern Virginia suburbs, and you see McAuliffe drop like a rock.
I think there's some truth to that. I also think there's some truth to the fact that McAuliffe and Moran just went at it each other, and Deeds stayed back. It reminds me, and I'm sure it reminds you, Ron, of what happened to Alan Dixon in Illinois in 1992.
When he lost to Carroll Moseley Braun.
Right. Carroll Moseley Braun was the third candidate in that race.
That's right.
Alan Dixon and somebody else were just fighting it out,
right.
And Moseley Braun
stayed came out of
it.
Nowhere and won. And we've seen it before. We saw Russ Feingold win the Democratic primary that way in Wisconsin back in 1992. And we also saw something very like that in the Democratic primaries for president in 2004 in Iowa.
Gephardt and Howard Dean
did each other in, and John Kerry emerged as the easy winner in Iowa and went on to the nomination.
And he became president.
Yes. In fact, he's in his second term. All right. And so Creed Eads now has to run in November against a Republican candidate who beat him for the attorney general office 4 years ago.
And that was Bob McDonnell, and it was by 323 votes.
323
votes. 2 million casts.
But I always remember that number, 323.
Because?
It was my draft number.
And it was also the amount that Bob McDonnell defeated Creed Eads for attorney general in 4 years ago. So anyway, at this point, if you had to ask me, I don't know. I mean, I think McDonnell wins. I always thought McDonnell had the lead all along, but I think Deeds may be the strongest Democratic candidate. He's not tarred as a liberal, which Brian Moran would have been. He's not tarred as a Clinton-esque character. Remember, before you think about Bill Clinton, he lost Virginia twice. Hillary got clobbered by Obama in Virginia in 2008. And McAuliffe is McAuliffe. He has this Syracuse accent.
Look, anybody who comes down to Virginia and says that he's going to help create jobs,
I'd be honored to have your vote because our challenges are too big.
It's not going to sound much like a Virginian, and it's going to look like a carpetbagger.
Well, look, Brian Moran was born near Boston. He had the Boston accent, but it was just McAuliffe was a national figure who parachuted into Virginia to make his first run for governor. When Chuck Robb did that in 1977, what he did, he first ran for lieutenant governor. It's not a big difference, but I think people appreciated that more. Somebody making his first bid for office, running for governor, I think that was overreaching.
It also depends a little bit what part of the country you're coming from into Virginia. If you're coming from due north, it's probably not the best direction.
He also raised $7.5 million, and there was a lot of feeling that perhaps he was trying to buy the election. Sometimes you absolutely can buy the election, and other times it just backfires.
Speaking of buying elections, John Corzine is the man who spent more money winning a statewide office in the United States than anyone else, and John Corzine is in big trouble up in New Jersey, so we could see this November two governorships in New Jersey and Virginia, both states that Barack Obama won, those governorships switching to the Republican Party. Quite easily could happen this November and will be seen as a major harbinger if that does happen.
Well, we always do that, and we always point to 1993 when the Republicans won.
Or 1989 when the Democrats won.
That's true, too. But we always point to 1993 when the Republicans won New Jersey, when Christy Todd Whitman beat Jim Florio, when George Allen won in Virginia, when Rudy Giuliani won in New York City. And then, look, 1994 came Newt Gingrich, so you know...
It was a big Republican tsunami building, and we saw the first indications of it in 93.
But sometimes it doesn't happen. Sometimes we try to make the case that what happens in New Jersey and Virginia have tremendous meaning. It'll be a referendum on Barack Obama. It'll be the future. It'll be a sign that the Republican Party is back to stay. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, unless it's not. Unless. All right. A couple of other states where a lot of stuff is going on. Let's talk about Florida, the Senate race there. Still Charlie Crist to lose, or is there an interesting Democratic option?
Well, yes and yes. I still think Charlie Crist wins that seat, holds it for the Republicans. That's when Mel Martinez is retiring. Marco Rubio is a conservative Cuban-American who many conservatives who feel that Charlie Crist is too much of a rhino, Republican in name only. They're backing Rubio, but a latest poll, Quinnipiac poll, shows Charlie Crist with a huge lead.
Huge lead.
But there's another Republican in the race. We talk about Terry McAuliffe's accent from Syracuse. We have Bob Smith, the former senator from New Hampshire, who is now running for the Senate in Florida.
Bob Smith is the guy who lost in his own primary.
Back in Sununu.
That's right, back in the 1990s.
No, 2002.
Was 2002 not part of the 90s? Okay. Okay. This is the Bob Smith who lost his own Republican primary back in 2002 to John Sununu, the younger. And what is he doing? What does he think he's doing down in the state of Florida running for the Senate? He's not going to get anywhere in that primary. You know the man. What's wrong with him?
Well, I wouldn't put it that way. He moved to Florida years ago, and actually he was thinking about running in 2004 for the Senate, considered it, didn't run it. But there was a video of Bob Smith on the internet where he explains his conservative philosophy and thinks that if you're not happy with Charlie Crist, and I think basically...
And you don't want to vote for somebody named Marco Rubio?
Right, because the kids play that in the pool. Marco Rubio.
All right, so the Republican field is crowded, although we do see it as still dominated by Governor Crist. What about the Democrats?
Well, that's surprising, too, because Kendrick Meek, African-American congressman from Miami, announced months ago. And
we've been expecting him to run for a long time.
Yeah. I mean, he's raised a lot of money. And Dan Gelber, the state senator from Miami, just dropped out of the race.
Stepped back,
because,
said no.
Look, Kendrick. Mm-hmm. But then Corinne Brown, the former congresswoman from northern Florida, who's also African-American, says, well, I'm running, too. Now, there's nothing... It's insulting, of course, to say that blacks can't run against each other, but it did catch me as surprising that Corinne Brown, given the fact that Kendrick Meek was thought to be...
Well, it came out of nowhere. Yeah. Everybody knew that Kendrick Meek was running, that this was his shot. And for her to suddenly do this without apparently, you know, consulting with very many people within the realm, you know, of Democrats in Florida, this was a shocker. And no one's really quite sure what's going on there. And it isn't helping Kendrick Meek in the long run. So we'll see what goes on there. And there's also, real quickly, a very competitive governor race there in 2010.
There is. It looks like Bill McCollum, the former congressman who ran for Senate twice, who is
one of the impeachment managers in 1998.
The current attorney general will be the Republican nominee, and Alex Sink, a woman, just to let you know, Alex Sink is a female. She is the chief financial officer, which is a statewide elected official in Florida. She will be the Democratic nominee. That's a very close race.
That's going to be an interesting race.
Very close, because everybody knows McCollum.
He's a traditional figure. He represents Florida's Republican.
And has been around for a long, long time. And not everybody knows Alex Sink, and yet the polls are very, very close.
Yes, and she does represent more of a, if you will, future view of where Florida politics are going. Okay, another state real quickly, Illinois.
Now, we thought that everybody in the world would be running against Roland Burris for the Senate. There was no shortage of Democrats who would love to have jumped in the contest. Of course, these same Democrats would have loved the appointment from Rod Blagojevich before Rod Blagojevich became Rod Blagojevich.
Before he became radioactive.
So Jan Schakowsky, a congresswoman from Chicago, I think Southside, who really wanted the seat, decided this week that she's not going to run against Burris in the primary, which I thought was a surprise. She said she didn't want to spend all her time raising money. She wanted to work on health care in Congress, and she wanted to be part of that.
I think it might have had something to do with the legal problems of her husband.
Well, there's also the fact that she may not be able to raise the money to run statewide. She's popular. She's very liberal, but I don't know if she could win statewide. There's still the state treasurer, who seems to be backed by Dick Durbin, who's running. Chris Kennedy, son of Robert Kennedy, is also in there. But there seems to be fewer and fewer Democrats challenging Burris than I would have expected, given all his problems.
Well, and especially because we expect that at some point or another, he's going to, if not step down or recuse himself, at least decide that he's not going to run for re-election.
Well, he's raised over $45 so far for his re-election, and you need 10 times that to run in Illinois.
At least 10 times.
And we still don't have a Republican candidate yet. Mark Kirk, the congressman, is watching the race. He's being wooed, obviously, and he's going to see obviously, it pays to see who the Democrats are running, but Mark Kirk would be probably the best chance for the Republicans to win back that seat.
The Republican Party in Illinois has had a very bad patch. They have had years in which they haven't been able to really mount a serious candidate for Senate or for the governorship. I cannot find a period of time in Illinois' history since the Civil War where they've had so much travail for the Republicans.
And you know, when Blagojevich won in 2002 for the first time as governor, it was decades.
Big Jim Thompson had dominated the state's politics in Springfield.
Jim Edgar
had come after him, and George Ryan. There had been just this long series.
Where's George Ryan now, by the way?
Prison.
Oh, okay.
He's serving a federal prison
That could
sentence.
Be why the Democrats have come back in Illinois.
Yes, it's a large part of it, but it's not the only thing, because here again, as in Florida and Pennsylvania and Ohio, demographics are changing, and people are less associating themselves with the Republican Party across the board, even where you haven't had people indicted for corruption.
But there is one place where the Republican Party is on the ascendancy, and that is in the New York State Senate.
Yes, in Albany, New York. What a place to look for a resurgence of Republican strength in a state where 26 of their 29 House seats are held by Democrats.
What's most fascinating about this is that the Republicans, first of all, controlled the state Senate for 43 consecutive years until the November 2008 elections. They lost it by one seat, and so they're in the minority. This week, they pulled off a palace coup. They convinced two Democrats to vote with them on reorganizing the state Senate. They took it away from Malcolm Smith, who was New York's first African-American Senate Majority Leader, give it to the Republicans. But the two Democrats they picked, not the paradigms of ethics.
Well, there are two Democrats representing the Bronx and Queens. Right. Now, Ken, of course, I cede to you on all matters Bronx. Would you say that there had ever been any cloud over the political ethics of any of the elected officials in the Bronx?
Well, except for these two. These two, the state senator from the Bronx is accused of looting a non-for-profit health agency. He's under state investigation. And the state senator from Queens is under indictment for slashing his girlfriend with a piece of glass. So I think that's interesting that in the name of reform, the Republicans picked these two particular Democrats to give them what seems to be a majority in the New York State Senate.
Well, you always pick the low-hanging fruit, do you not? That's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. When it's time to change, then it's time to change. Don't fight the tide, come along for the ride, don't you see? When it's time to change, you've got to rearrange. Who you are and what you're gonna be. Changes you've been through.